Okay, today is Wednesday, March 29th, second day of the month of Nisan. This is the Women's Chumash Share at the end of Perek Yud Gimel. Okay, Rabotai. We are at the conclusion of Perek Yud Gimel, which we're going to finish up today. We actually read the psukim last week, but there are several ha'arot that I want to go through nonetheless. So we're at the end of Yud Gimel. The Torah describes initially Lot's separation from Avram and winding up near Sodom. And then the Torah tells us that Avram... God spoke to Avram and told him, take a look at Eretz Yisrael, travel up and down the length and breadth of the land, and he decided to pitch his tent in Elonei Mamre, which happened to be in Hebron. So I'd like to begin with just a brief discussion about Lot, who we spent a lot of time on, and the text offers very, very little in terms of a clue as to who he was. My point of departure is Rashi's comment, which we read inside last week. I'll show it to you again, just to remind you. When it says that in Pasuk Yud Aleph, that Lot selected the plains of the Yarden, and he traveled Mikedem, eastbound. No problem, simple pshat, eastbound. Anybody remember Rashi's Midrash? Yes? The what? Good. Mikadmono shalolam. Exactly what Rashi said. It's obviously a Midrash, that's not what the word Mikedem means. But Rashi says that Lot abandons God completely. Abandons God completely. And I'd like to dissect and analyze for a few minutes about this Mr. Lot. We will be introduced to him again at the end of chapter 14. When the Torah will deviate for a very unusual reason, it's one of the most difficult parshiot to understand, a battle of four kings against five kings, which at first blush has less than zero to do with Avram or anybody else. And the parshanim struggle, why does the Torah spend an entire chapter talking about this? At the very end, Avram gets involved to save his nephew Lot. So question number one will be, if we are to take Rashi's words literally, that Lot abandons Kadmono Shel Olam, why is Avram prepared to risk his life and 318 other people, that's what he was able to get, not that many more, 318 people to save Lot against one of the kings? If he became an idolater, if he had an opportunity to live with Avram all his life, see the path of God, and decided to actively reject it and take on the lifestyle of stone, why is Avram prepared to risk his life, and even more difficult, to enlist an army of 318 people to save his life? For what? Why? What did he deserve? What did he do that would have enabled him to be saved? To be saved. That's question number one. Question number two. Can we actually fault Lot for kicking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B8, Vayishman Yishurun, what's the word? Vayiv'at. When the Jew becomes fat, sometimes he kicks God away. Can we really blame him? Let's compare the trek initiated by Avram from Haran and the one from Lot from Haran. What initiated Avram's decision to leave Ur Kasdim and Haran? What initiated it? What? Good, yeah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming to you and saying something. Now, it wasn't just an empty tzivui. There were plenty of promises associated with it. E'escha otcha l'goy gadol, va'avorcha mivarcheka, u'mikalelcha a'or. Not bad conditions. Not bad conditions. To have anybody who blesses you will be blessed, anybody who curses you will be cursed. How many of those conditions were shared with Lot? None. So on what basis does Lot actually leave Haran and join Avram's camp? Not because of the promise made from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Lot, because there weren't any promises. So when you have somebody, he might have been a little desperate. Let's operate. Let's just be a playwright and fill in the blank. He didn't have much left. His father had died. Haran was killed, actually, in the Kivshan Ha'esh. And he had nothing else but to hang on, to cling to his family.
Was he married?
Now that we don't know. Yeah. We do not know. At the time, we don't know. We later do know that he was married because he had two daughters. So we assume it was not artificial insemination at the time. Then what phenomenon happens to Lot, which the Torah does make a point of telling us?
He gets rich.
Exactly. He becomes rich. And now, what's running through Lot's mind, like many people who become rich quite suddenly? What runs through a person's mind who becomes terribly successful? This is me. Koichi va'otzem yodi osoli esachayim hazeh. God didn't speak to me. I don't know who this God is. So is it terribly shocking that under those circumstances Lot leaves Avram's camp and decides to join the people that walk on his own, particularly in a land which is highly fertile? And he's got lots of cattle. The Torah tells us that. He's got lots of cattle. Is it terribly shocking? No. It's not terribly shocking. Third question. We read a story later on about Malachim. Malachim. And Rashi and other Parshanim always argue about the word Malachim in the early text of Bereshit. What are the two choices of Malachim?
Messengers
or angels. And of course Rashi always selects the angel interpretation. So that when Shlosha Anashim Nitzavim Alav in Parshat Vayera, these are three angelic angels from God, each one sent with a specific mission. And what was one of the missions? Lahatzilat Lot. This idolater is now meriting to be saved by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Not just Avram's initiative trying to get involved with 318 soldiers. A messenger of God is trying to save him. Why? After all, he traveled mikadmona. He abandoned God. Why is God trying to rescue somebody who abandoned him in a miraculous fashion?
In the narrative, Rashi doesn't use that as an excuse.
I didn't say. I'm just playing off Rashi's comment. Once we're gonna explore him to death. Try to understand, in light of Rashi's comment, why do all these things happen? It's not the pshat, there's no doubt about it.
inherited his family because he's from that family?
Maybe.
He thought he was going to
get it. That is a possibility. There is a possibility, and I will show you a pasuk in just a second that echoes your attention, that echoes your sin. There is a pasuk which says, and it's written, please open up to chapter 14, verse 12 for a second. Chapter 14, verse 12, because that idea comes through quite clearly in the pasuk. Read Pasuk Yudbet, and you are Ibn Ezra. Not Rashi, who was Ibn Ezra. You're Ibn Ezra, who will ask questions on the text that you can figure out when you're in the 10th grade. What's the question you're going to ask? What? What's wrong with Ben? That's not the...
It says won't.
That's the question. There's nothing wrong with defining Lot as Ben Achi Avram. But you don't say, and he took Lot and his wealth, the nephew of Avram. That makes no sense whatsoever.
It almost sounds like you're saying that the
Rechush
belongs to the...
Excellent! Says the Kutzker in his inimitable fashion. You know what was the greatest rechush that Lot owned? He was Ben Achi Avram. That was his rechush. So sometimes you're right. The mere fact that you are family to Avram might answer that question. It's a very good suggestion. It is possible.
Do you want an answer now, by the way?
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
I'm asking lots of questions, not because I have to waste 20 minutes.
No, are you interested in our answering?
Yeah, I'm gonna suggest something.
Oh, okay.
Is this the first time you've come to the shir?
Weren't they capturing Lot because he was family of Abraham?
We don't know. There is no evidence in the text that was, and he just happened to have been Kinishba Achiv. That's all the Torah tells us. Vayishma, somebody told him he was captured. It doesn't say that he was taken captive because he was... It might be, but there is no indication in the text, and I don't recall a midrash that even suggests that. So I want to suggest the following. There is an unusual aspect of Lot. Despite the fact that he leaves Kadmono Shel Olam, the text itself tells us that he retained loyalty to at least one tradition of Avraham, the Haknasa Sorchin. And not only did he retain loyalty, he put his life in danger for that Haknasa Sorchin. Because when the text tells us that the Anshe Sdom came, what did they threaten? What did they threaten? Hotziu Esanashim, if not, V'naharge, we're going to kill all of you. So Lot, for some reason, is holding on to something about Avram. The text tells us that when he invited them, these angels, whoever they are, guests and angels, he fed them. The Torah tells us the menu, what he fed them. And Rashi comments a sec because he gave them matzos that it was Pesach time. So, you know, and so on and so forth. So you see, what you can try to draw is a dichotomy about Lot himself. He has left tradition, there is no doubt, but there is something still gnawing at him. There's something still gnawing at him. Hello?
Hi, how are you?
Okay, I'm in the middle of the shir. Okay, I'll call you later. There's still something attaching him unto Avram, and that attachment is at such that he's willing to pay a price, the price of his life. And this happens to what? be something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu operates with. We had mentioned this previously in the name of the Rambam, and this is perfect evidence of this Rambam. Who remembers how Rambam defined tzaddik versus rasha? I told this to you. Who remembers? Come on, you got to remember.
Tzaddik
versus rasha.
Not ra versus rasha.
How? What did the Rambam definitively reject? Quantity of mitzvot. Rambam writes, because it was the prevalent theory, that the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides on Yom Kippur and Le'olam HaEmes, if you're a tzaddik, he sits there with a calculator. And he counts everything up. Okay? If there are more good deeds, you're a tzaddik. If there are more inappropriate acts, you're a rasha. Says the Rambam, no. The Rambam doesn't do that. The Rambam has his little favorites. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's got his favorites. And we just don't know what his favorites are. But it is possible, says the Rambam, that somebody can have 500 Averot, but the one mitzvah that means something to HaKadosh Baruch Hu overrides those 500 Averot, and he is inscribed as a tzaddik. And the converse, says the Rambam. There are certain Averot that are despicable in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's eyes. So from our educational point of view, we make a point of telling everybody, you can't select and choose. Every single mitzvah is of equal stature. Equal stature. But that's not the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu operates. You can have somebody who has 5,000 Averot, but he did the one mitzvah, or the converse. Somebody has 5,000 mitzvot, but he did the one thing that gnaws at HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He thinks it's nauseating. And he writes you down as a rasha. As a rasha. Now, we know that Chazal go out of their way to tell us, don't start wasting 5 seconds of your life trying to figure out which ones are the ones that are called. You'll never get. And it communicates to us, it emerges to us, I think I'm pretty sure I told this to you, and if not, it's good to repeat it anyhow. Rashi's comment on the simplest pasuk in the whole Torah, in which there's no need for anybody to comment anything, and Rashi comments on every single word of the text. And if Rashi comments, you know that there is a problem. So open up to Shmot chapter 20, verse 1. We're going to read it in 8 weeks on the first day of Shavuos. See? Forget about Pesach. Who cares about Pesach passed. Pesach's over with. First day of Shavuos. Chapter 20, verse 1. It is the introductory pasuk to the Aseret HaDibrot. Not only can a 10th grader translate that pasuk, a 1st grader can translate. 2nd grade. When do you get Chagigat HaChumash? I only went to 50 of them. What grade is it? 2nd grade. Okay. So by a 3rd grade, you can translate this pasuk. Vayedaber Elohim et kol hadvarim ha'elelemor. And God said all of these words. You'll take a look at Rashi. Rashi's bothered by every word in this pasuk. I'm not going through the whole Rashi. But the word kol, take a look at Rashi's comment on the word kol. First of all, what's his question?
Obviously, he has said all.
Yeah. If it had said, Vayidaber Elohim et hadvarim ha'ele, would I say he skipped, he only said 9 of them? And he skipped one of them? Of course he said all of them. They're about to be listed. So what's Rashi's answer?
He said
all Dibrot at the same time. Something that the human mouth cannot mouth and the human ear cannot perceive. So I ask you, I'm going to ask the Rabbi Nishar. But the Rav already asked the Rabbi Nishar, so I don't have to answer. Are you being a crack artist? What are you doing this for? To demonstrate your might? We already saw Kriyas Yamsuf. We saw Melchemes Amalek. We saw Makkah Pachol Road, nine other Makkah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had ample opportunity to demonstrate his unusual ability. He didn't have to say 10 Dibrot at the same time to prove that he is God. So the Rav suggested, I told you where this was, Muncie Park Hotel, 1972. Midwinter vacation, midwinter conference of the RCA. It was snowing like crazy. I drove the rug there. I was scared stiff. He was thinking of cancer because of snow and decided to go. This was one of the best shiurim I ever heard. Explaining this pasuk in the Chumash for 2.5 hours. Every word in Rashi. That's all he did. It was pointless. So he said, he gave that famous line. If you believe every story in the Medrash, that it could not have happened, you're a heretic. If you believe every story in the Medrash that it did happen, you're a fool.
Yeah.
You have to know when the Medrash is trying to communicate an idea and when the Medrash is willing to communicate reality. So here we're about to have the Aseret HaDibrot. Imagine if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be on... Who's your favorite late night guy? Letterman? Who was your favorite?
He's gone.
Who was it?
Stephen
Colbert.
He's your favorite? But who's your favorite all time? Carson, of course. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu was on Johnny Carson. And he asked him to give him his top 10. So what would Johnny Carson do? He'd write down the first thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu say and list it as what? Number 10. And then you go down to the bottom, to number 1. So when you present lists, what happens is your tendency is to think that that which is recited last is least significant or most significant, and then the reverse. Is that the way we are to look at the Aseret HaDibrot? So how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicate to us that every single Dibra is of equal stature, said them all at the same time, then he had to say it again because nobody understood one word that he said. But the message is, don't think that Lo Tignov is less significant than Lo Tirzach. Don't think that Shabbat is less significant than Kaveh Yisavich HaVesimach. And the Rambam, in effect, tells us, don't spend 5 minutes of your life trying to figure out which one HaKadosh Baruch Hu likes. But there is one that he does. Just looking at the text that we have studied, I and you should come to the conclusion that one of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's favorite babies is Atmasasara. You have somebody who rejected his authority completely, removed himself mikadmono shel olam, and yet is deserving of angels, Avram's involvement, and so on and so forth. Why? Because he did hachnasas arach. He maintains some tradition of Avram's family. And that, for some reason, made an impact upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A huge impact. A huge impact. Furthermore, you all acknowledge the text that what ultimately changed Lot's mind, the fact that he became wealthy. There is a lengthy Malbim. And it's not only the Malbim. I'm going to give you two scenarios. You tell me which is more difficult to overcome. You are in a concentration camp, or you are the most successful American Jew on the planet. Which is the greatest challenge to maintaining loyalty and faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's not an easy question. Not an easy. Because there were a lot of people who saw hell worse than Gehenna and gave up. And we don't judge them. We don't God for the judgment. But most seem to feel that the greatest test that we experience is the test of success. It's the test of success. The affluence. When it's so easy to say, Vuskaf Icha Rabbeinu Shalomas, who needs a bunch? In fact, every year in school we have what's called book day. So everybody reads the whole book, and then we have a full day of sessions. We invite guest speakers, Judaic studies, English teachers. Everybody talks about the book from a different perspective. So I selected as my topic, the name of the book this year was called Outliers. And I selected that pasuk to prove a pasuk in the Chumash. The pasuk of Kochi v'otzim yadi asoliyas achayil hazeh. It's my capacity, my genius, that made me successful. Why? Because the author said, and he did studies in 68 different areas, that there is a critical number that you have to engage in order to become from a regular person to somebody who's a genius, an outstanding person, the spectacular hockey player. What was, anybody remember the number? 10,000 hours of work. That was his thing, his formula. 10,000 hours of work. 10,000. And I'll just give you one illustration from one of my favorites, from sports. There are hardly any hockey players that are born October, November, and December. Hardly any. The overwhelming majority of hockey players in the NHL are born in January, February, and March. And he comes up with this theory that since they're older, they're a little more mature for that age. They're a little stronger, usually, for that age. And therefore, they are selected for the superior teams in the little junior Canadian league. And they get the 10,000 hours on the best ice conditions, whereas somebody else is playing hockey in his backyard when the little pond freezes. 10,000 hours. So when you become Wayne Gretzky, with all due respect, you better know who Wayne Gretzky is. He's only the greatest hockey player by far. In every single sport, there are statistics, right? Who hit the most home runs. So the gap between the number one and the number two is usually 1%, something like that. A couple of home runs. The gap between Gretzky and everybody else is 1,000 points scored. Gretzky has scored 1,000 more points in his NHL career than the number two player. How did Gretzky? Because he put in not 10,000 hours, 13,000 hours practicing. So when you become successful and you start saying, you know what? My success? Why? I put in the work. I put in my 10,000 hours. That's why I did. Where does the Rabbeinu Shalom enter the picture? There is no Rabbeinu Shalom entering the picture. So, Lot, the Torah gives us this one little piece of information about Lot in Pasuk Bet. One piece of information. That begam l'Lot, haya mikneh rav, and so on and so forth. And that causes him to what? To move in a different direction. Because if I am successful, what don't I need? I don't need a Rabbeinu Shalom. I don't need a Rabbeinu Shalom. So the drama of separating Avram and Lot, it's not just an off-the-cuff comment of Rashi. Oh, we'll darshan the word mikedem to mean mikadmono shel olam. Rashi could be giving us the reasons why Lot decided to part company. Avram is successful because he believes in his stupid God. I'm successful. I don't believe in that God. Never heard of him. He never spoke to me a word. And I'm just as successful as he is. I don't need him. It's just that I know how to be a shepherd. I know when there is lack of grazing, I'm going to go to the best grazing grass possible. That's what's happening with Lot in this particular unit, yes.
In a way, doesn't this foreshadow when Yaakov leaves Laban? He also becomes wealthy. He has a lot of sheep. And he perhaps is almost about to fall into that trap of thinking that since he had this
little formula, right?
The sheep,
right?
And then God, and he dreams, and you know the dream is basically, get out of here. You're starting to think about your sheep too much. And
that's an excellent analogy. Careful. Excellent analogy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to him in a dream, and what does he show him in the dream? That what? Your father, Emesh, Einenu Iti Kitmol Shilshom. I start noticing in the dream that your pop Lavan is not treating me the same way. Yeah. It could be a message by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You think you're getting a little too
wrapped up
in your own success. With his own, I still haven't figured out how that system worked. The Nekudim, the Tluim, how he branded and mixed the spotted ones, how he did that, I'm not quite, there's long Ramban trying to figure it out. Maybe we'll get to it, but that's a very good analogy. It's a very good analogy. Point number two. Please go to page number 3 for a minute. And I want to make this point because it's important today for us. Am Yisrael of our generation, 50 years after Kibbush Yerushalayim. Remember I told you last week that the Kli Yakar bought into the Ramban's idea that there are two dimensions happening here. The Sa' Einecha, to open up your eyes. What was that? Don't tell me you forgot that. Sa' Einecha, what was the Sa' Einecha? The spiritual beauty of Yerushalayim. And what is Kum Hitalech Ba'aretz? The physical conquest. Good. And Kli Yakar elaborated upon an idea that the Ramban had originated. Look on the left-hand side on the bottom. Look what he writes. Look what the Kli Yakar writes. V'to'elet ruchani zeh, this benefit that God awarded Avram by asking him to open up his eyes and see the magnitude, the splendor of walking on Rehov King George in Yerushalayim, to walk on Rehov Yafo in Yerushalayim, lo yasir mizar'o ad olam. Not only is the legal acquisition of the land going to remain in the hands of Avram's children permanently, but even the capacity to what? To recognize the unique spiritual quality of Israel, particularly Yerushalayim, that will never be forgotten as well. Listen to this. Ki af bizman shebeit hamikdash shelemata eino bebinyano, even though the Beit HaMikdash down here is not built, it's still not built. We have a mosque sitting on the top of the Harabayit. Mikol makom, Habayit HaMikdash shelemala, HaMechuvan negdo nitzchi lo yasur liolam. The Medrash and Kabbalah mentioned this 68,000 times, that the Beit HaMikdash here is built directly corresponding to the Beit HaMikdash that's up in heaven. And even though this Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, that one obviously cannot be. U'v'chol zman yored mimenu hashefa al zera Avraham hamikudash. And the spirit of what that Mikdash in heaven represents somehow continues to descend and impacts the children of the holy Abraham. Umitam zeh, shleimim, wholesome people, good Jews, v'chein rabim, lots of Jews, nichsiva nafsham la'amol b'makom hakadosh hahu. What did the Jews do? Said Kliyakar. You went onto the Har Habayit. You went onto the Har Habayit. Why? Because you wanted to feel the pressure. You wanted to touch the, he says, you wanted to touch the stones, the holy stones of the Har Habayit. This piece of history is part of the revisionist history that segments of the Jewish community like to engage in. There are Achenu B'nai Yisrael in every way. In every way. But they like to write revisionist history. There is one of the greatest halachic works on every Yom Tov written at the Tkumat HaMedina, written by a great Rav, a great Zionist Rav. His name is Rabbi Yosef Zevin. He wrote a book called, three volumes, HaMo'adim V'Halacha. It's been translated into English. It is a spectacular work, which doesn't give you halachot like Shulchan Aruch. He gives you background, halachic background to understand how this and the debates. It's a spectacular, he's got one on the Seder, every spectacular. So in his book, when he wrote it initially, he spoke about Medinat Yisrael in the modern day context. And he wrote that Medinat Yisrael is Reishit Tzmichat Geulaten. Now, certain segments of the Jewish community couldn't believe that Rav Zevin, who was Mizrahi at heart, but outside a little more agudanik and yeshiva, would ever use those words. So you buy any edition today of Hamoadim Mahalacha, those three words have been taken out of the text. Doesn't say that he said that the that Medinat Yisrael is Reishit Tzmichat Geulaten. Doesn't exist anymore. And I can give you 5,000 such illustrations. 5,000. Rambam wrote a letter to his son when he finally came to Ir HaKodesh Yerushalayim. And he writes, I ascended the Har Habayit. Went on the Har Habayit. And the Meiri, 200 years later, Rabbi Menachem Hami, one of the last Rishayim, writes, V'gam ra'isi be'enai me'ot me'ot anashim olim lahar habayit l'regel aliyah. To be mekayim in the midst of aliyah l'regel. Aliyah l'regel. So Rishayim, and the Kli Yakar is 500 years later, in the 1700s, are testifying to the fact that people went on the Har Habayit. Went on the Har Habayit. And the reason why I go on the Har Habayit is not because the Rambam went on the Har Habayit. It's because of what Rav Goren said. When I was in Israel in Keren B'Yavne, so during Chodesh Nisan, you didn't come home. Nobody came home in Chodesh Nisan. The yeshiva took us on tours all over Israel. And one time we had the privilege of listening at that time to the Rav HaRashi of Tzahal, who later became the Rav HaRashi of Medinat Yisrael, Rav Goren, explaining why we should all go on the Har Habayit. Because if we don't, the only ones who will be there are the Arabs. And then they're going to say it belongs to them. A Navi 40 years ago. That's exactly what happens.
Which is the Jewish.
You have to go. We all have to go. Yes, there are parts of the Har Habayit where we're not allowed to go. We know. And every religious tour guide who goes, that's why you go only around the perimeter. Around the perimeter. Yes, you cannot go into the Mosque of Omar. You cannot. There's a Chiv Kares. Because we don't have the ashes of the Paraduma. But the outside, the Mizgera, the outside, is kosher for all of everybody. Well, not talking about whether you have to go to the mikvah or not. That's not my issue right now. But you have to go. Because otherwise, we're going to lose it. And those who go, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein once said this, he said, I have no problem going on Har HaBayit. I have never gone, he said. But I think it should be people who believe religiously that this will be the height of their religious experience in their lifetime. If you are such a person that you are looking for spirituality and you're looking to have a real moment, then you go on Har. It's amazing. It's an amazing, it was filthy. They keep it with such, they are so disrespectful to their own mosque. There are two mosques, and the other one, Al-Aqsa, 50,000 people come to pray every Friday. There's so much garbage there. They don't take care of it. It's terrible. And it's the only place in the world where we can't offer a prayer. Only place in the world. You can go to the Kremlin.
They did. Remember they snuck in.
Yes, you sneak in. But sometimes you get a guy, I had a student of mine, well-known Shlomo Klapper, who was taken off the Har HaBayis because he was moving a little 17-year-old kid, 18-year-old kid, taken off and brought into jail. And he was questioned because one of them Arab guys said he was praying on the Har HaBayis. So he says that this is part of the lecha etnena. The lecha etnena. I'm not only giving it to you, but it's ulizaracha ad olam. Lizaracha ad olam. And I wanted to show it to you, and just go to page 4 for 1 second for a brief halachic analysis. The Rambam puts into halachic categories what Kli Yakar said 500 years later in a spiritual sense. Look at, I bracketed halacha 15, but forget about it. Look at 16. The Rambam is going to tell us why the Har HaBayit has retained its Kedusha, despite the fact that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and every single Jew was kicked out of Israel. And as I told you last week, when Jews are not in control of Israel, at the first time when they came in, they forfeited the sanctity, and you're not chayav Trumot HaMaasot. Look at Halacha Tet Zayin, about 10 lines from the bottom. V'lama ani omer b'mikdash v'Yerushalayim, kitsha rishona, kitsha le'atid lavo. Why do I say that the first sanctification of Yerushalayim and the Mikdash? Who did the first sanctification? Who sanctified Israel the first time? Yehoshua. And then Shlomo built the Beit HaMikdash. Yehoshua's sanctification of Tel Aviv, Haifa, Bnei Brak, everything came to a halt when the Jews were exiled into Babylonia. Because if you don't have conquest, you don't have sanctity. Except for Yerushalayim and the Mikdash. Why, says the Rambam, does that never lose its sanctity? And Ezra, when he came back, did not have to sanctify Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash. Why? Why? Don't ever forget this line. Lefi shekedushat HaMikdash v'Yerushalayim b'nei hashchina u'shchina eina b'teila. That which sanctifies Yerushalayim and the Mikdash is not Yehoshua, not me, not you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sanctified it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't be terminated. So Yerushalayim and the Har HaBayit retain its Kedusha. Now, in the middle of the page, you see, I'm not going to read it now. You see Hasagas HaRavid? The Ravid is the guy who argued with the Rambam all the time. He argued all the, not all the time, but lots of times. So I'm just going to look at to you to look at his first comment. Look at where I bracket. Amar Avraham, Svaras Atzmohi, Velo Yodati Me'ayinlo. What does that mean, Svaras Atzmo? The Rambam made this up himself. I have no idea where he got it from. He writes, that's a very mild critique of the Ravid against the Rambam. He writes, sometimes, the Rambam's thing was Svarat Ni'arim, children think that way. Or it's not worth the paper it's written on. That's the Ravid. He writes against the Rambam. But the Rambam wrote, Shechina Eina B'Teila. And it's our job, our response, not only Yehuda Glick, it's our responsibility to make sure that we retain control and sovereignty on the Har HaBayit. Because it was sanctified by the Shechina, and the Shechina Eina B'Teila. Eina, yes.
The writing does not agree with this.
Rabbi holds there's no kedusha on the Har HaBayit today. A ki who
said? So there are those who believe.
So according to the Rabbi, why would anybody go on the Har HaBayit? It's a historical archaeological place. Nice.
So there are many who agree with him, obviously.
Oh yes, there are. But the halacha is against the Rabbi. The halacha is like the Rambam, and still they say, "Oh, we're worried where you're going to walk. Where you're going to walk? You can worry about this." That's why most people tell you not to go. Because they're afraid. It's very simple. Take one soldier and say, no Jew goes beyond this point. Stands there with his machine gun, right in front of wherever it is. This is where you're allowed to walk to. No Jew is allowed to go. So today, Orthodox Jews don't go on Har HaBayit. And the Chinese go, and the Japanese go, and the Australians go. Everybody goes on Har HaBayit. You know, except us, to us, who it's meaningful for, because we pass them like the Rambam against the Rabbi. Just want to know, the Rabbi said that. That it has no kiddush whatsoever, zero. It's like a team of kiddush. Yeah, someplace else. At home. Lakewood or something like that. Lakewood. So, That's what he says, and it's important to know. Point, yes.
If the Shechina is there, how does allow the Arabs and the Nazis?
Because Hakadosh Baruch Hu does not interfere today al pineis any longer. Everything that Hakadosh Baruch Hu does is nisim b'derech hateva. Nisim b'derech hateva. That's how Medinat Yisrael was created. That's how we won Yerushalayim. Right? The Air Force bombed the Egyptian Air Force while it's still on the ground. That was a Nes Min HaShemayim. But it's Bederech HaTeva. That's the difference between prophetic times and non-prophetic time. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not do Nisim Giluyim any longer. You know why? He doesn't have to. Because we believe in him even without Nisim Giluyim. Those generations didn't believe in him until they saw Kriyas Yamsuf. But we don't need it. So one day HaKadosh Baruch Hu is waiting for us to take control and say, we're the Balabatim here today. Not the Arabs. We are the Balabatim. So we should all become like the town, like Chashmonaim. Every eighth day of the month, Chashmonaim, every eighth day, a bus from Chashmonaim goes on the Har HaBayit. A full bus, 40, 50 people. My sister told me they go all the time. They decided on the eighth, Chashmonaim, that's their day to protect the Har HaBayit. Yes?
I just want to go back to Lot for a second.
No. Who's he?
Only because when you pose the question.
Yes.
I had a thought in my mind, and you could tell me that I'm off, but I just wanted to.
Please go right.
Okay. So I just felt like
the mother of our assistant rabbi. How are we going to turn it on?
It just seemed to me that one of the reasons that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to take Lot back was a message to all of us. when somebody, part of our family, leaves Kadono Shalom, mm-hmm. we go to the greatest lengths to bring them back.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Yes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, from his daughters came out.
But they didn't do it.
I know, they did, okay, but it's an excellent point that was worth interrupting. Had it not been good, I would have let you know as well. Please now check as well, page, please, yes, take a look at page 3 again. A technical grammatical short point by Ibn Ezra. The text itself always uses the expression that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells them to walk, to see, when he tells Yehoshua, Moshe, Ki lecha etnena. Etnet. Take a look at Ibn Ezra's remark on the top of page 3, I bracketed for you. Tell me what Ibn Ezra says, and he brings the sharpest proof text for it, which you should remember because we read it twice a year, Parshas Acharei Mos and on Yom Kippur morning. What does Ibn Ezra, how does he interpret the word ve'etnena? Correct. As opposed to a ma'aseh nesina. The word natan always implies I have something va'ani noten etzel lach. Netina is usually transfer of something. Says Ibn Ezra, no. Ve'etnena bidibu. And he quotes a pasuk. What pasuk does he quote? It says v'natan Otam al Rosh Hasa'ir. It's talking about the vidui of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. Who is the Kohen Gadol mitvadeh for on Yom Kippur? All of our Yisrael. First himself and his family, then Shokarek, Shevet Mechilasecha, and then Adak Yishurun. What does it mean? Does he go over to you and say, can I please have your hand? He puts it on the goat? Mm-hmm. No. V'natan, he declares the vidui. He declares the vidui. Here comes the enormous halachic significance. Nitina, if I give you something, somebody can take it away just as easily as I gave it to you. But if the person who gave it to you is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the manner in which he gave it was through what? Dibur. What do we say in Yigdal every Friday night? What characteristic is about Dvaro Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What is it? Emet. Emet. If God says something, there's absolute 1,000% truth to it. 1,000% truth. Dvaro shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What do we say? At the end of the davening of Rosh Hashanah, right before the conclusion of Baruch Hu. Udvarcha emet v'kayam la'ad. That's what Ibn Ezra is telling us from a halachic standpoint. Avram, you have nothing to worry about my gift. Because I'm not giving it to you physically. If I was giving it to you physically, somebody's a little shrugger, you can come and grab it. Mm-hmm. But I'm giving it to you bidibur. Bidibur. And dvarcha emet v'kayam la'ad. La'ad. And in fact, from a halachic sense, and this is what I'm going to close, every single bracha that we make, every long bracha, where it has multiple themes, the last theme before the word Baruch Atah Hashem equals the conclusion after the words Baruch Atah Hashem. It's called Me'ein HaChatima Samuch LeChatima. You say an idea near the end, right before the end. I'll give you two examples from Shmon Esrei. Okay? In Shmon Esrei, we say multiple things about God. He is Mechalkel Chayim B'Chesed. Right? He is the Mashif HaRuach Umarid HaGashem. But what's the conclusion of the bracha itself? Baruch Atah Hashem Mechayei HaMikim. So what's the last phrase before? V'ne'eman Atah Mechayei. That's the rule for all brachot. The rule for all brachot is, think about when you daven Maariv. The conclusion is Baruch Atah Hashem Shomer Amo Yisrael La'ad. Well, in the text itself, we also ask the Hagen Ba'adenu, please, Me'oye, Dever, Cherev, Rav. The last phrase, Ushmor Tseisenu Uvoenu. Why? Because the bracha ends, Baruch Atah Hashem, Shomer Amo Yisrael La'ad. Always. So now I ask you the question. What's the actual conclusion of the text of the Shemona Esrei on Rosh Hashanah? Everybody remembers the song which we grew up in today, which nobody likes to sing anymore. Melech HaKalaret. How does Uvarcha Emet V'Kayam La'ad finish, match that statement? Because it is the same. You know why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Melech HaKalaret? Because Dvarcha Emet V'Kayam La'ad. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu says something, what did he say on day number one? What did God say on day number one of creation? Yehi Or. Is there still light out there? So God is the Melech HaKalar, so he controls the light. What did he say on day number two? Yehi Rakia Bein Mayim L'Mayim. That's why God's the Melech HaKalar. So the phrase Udvarcha Emet V'Kayam La'ad is indeed the theme that amplifies, how do I know that Melech HaKalaretz? Same thing here, says Ibn Ezra. Ki lecha ulezaracha etein et haaretz hazot al yidei dibur. Therefore, Avram, you've got nothing to worry about, because my dibur remains forever. Just as the Kohen Gadol does on Yom Kippur. But he has no guarantee because he's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking. It's his Dibur asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he places his hands on the head of the goat that's going to be sent to Eretz Gzeirah, please, Ribbono Shel Olam, please forgive all of the Averot of Am Yisrael. We'll stop here. Now, next week, I don't think there's going to be a class, because I remember last year, we did have a class and there were two people. Next, there's no class next week. We'll resume right at the end.
Tonight,
I have the Gush, tonight, the Gush dinner. I've got a class tomorrow night, 8:15.
Wednesday, the day after yesterday, not today.
not that right. No, it's not going to be the same time. Hey, you're all home. Home fiancé. Great. Yes. Yeah, it is. Especially how kids say that it is. That makes it. Yes. What? Which one? I don't know. What? Really? Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know.